behind, and we've got a very full agenda here. So I want to ask commissioners to think carefully about the questions that you want to ask, and make sure you're being efficient with the limited time we have on today's agenda. We also are instituting something slightly different this meeting, in which we're going to allow the Wildlife Committee to have some time on each agenda item to help inform the rest of the commission of the kinds of discussions held during the Wildlife Committee meetings. So that will now be integrated as a part of the commission discussion of each item. We'll try it this way. So moving on, number three is hunting practices. This is a rule briefing and a public hearing. And Dave Ware and Don Craigie are here to guide us through this topic.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, for the record, my name is Dave Ware. I'm the Game Division Manager for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And you're going to hear from me and my staff most of the day today. So this is kind of our big three-year season-setting process, kind of toward winding down. And so since I'm the first one up today, I think I will briefly remind everyone of where we're at in terms of this three-year process, and especially because there are some differences or some changes with this three-year process than there have been in the past. So this was an abbreviated process for us in terms of a three-year package. We do major regulation changes on a three-year basis that gives us time to evaluate the changes that were made in the previous 3 years, but also some stability for hunters in knowing what their seasons are going to be like for the three-year process. And then we do come back every year and talk about permit levels mainly, but any adjustments we need to be made that need to be made because of emergent or necessary means. One of the issues this year, though, is that the governor suspended non-critical rulemaking, and so we're honoring that request, and so we have, again, truncated or shortened up our process and the number of rules that we were looking at making modifications to. So this three-year package ended up being a two-stage public involvement process. We had a fairly major scoping effort in August. We had over 4,000 people respond through email and other means, including 150 of those that attended four public meetings that we conducted. And then the next stage is, of course, the process we're in now, which is the Commission's standard rulemaking process. And so the recommendations became available in early February, and we took comment through the 21st. We also had a Game Management Advisory Council meeting on February 11th and walked through the recommendations with them and got their recommendations on the proposals. We've since made some recommended adjustments, and those are in your notebook based on the public comment that we received. And on some of the discussions with the Game Management Advisory Council. Of course, this is the public hearing, and you'll receive a testimony today. That will be taken into consideration as well. And then the commission will make its decision on April 13th and 14th. So the governor's suspension of non-critical rulemaking did have some exceptions in it. It's for those rules that are required by state or federal law. Those rules that are protect public welfare, and I'm abbreviating these or abridging these, those rules that are necessary to protect public welfare or avoid threats to the natural resource, and those rules that are beneficial to the regulated entities. So we did try to limit the rules, and one of the main things that we were looking at are issues that reflect important conservation and management concerns, that address a specific strategy from the game management plan, and all of our landowner hunting permit cooperators, their contracts were due up, and so we had to revise those. At the same time, there were a lot of issues that we chose not to move forward with. It's probably the biggest one that we always end up debating and dealing with on a three-year package are some of the allocation issues between some of the different users, and so we've tried to stay away from that during this process. So agency staff identified about 40 issues to begin with. We winnowed those down to about six that had statewide significance. We did have some more additional issues that were added during our public process. And again, all of that led up to the public comment on our proposals that we've been receiving since 1st of February. We've summarized those comments. Those are also in your notebook. It did result, as I said, in several recommended adjustments, but there will be a few floor amendments that we're going to recommend today as well. And so we'll provide you with those as we move through our testimony. So let's get started. This agenda item is called hunting practices. It's really a roll up of several different issues rules into this category or this agenda item. And so the main ones are crossbow rules, baiting of waterfowl, hunting at night, and the use of electronic equipment, in particular illuminated nocks and waterfowl decoys. So the intent of this recommendation really was, for crossbow rules, was really meaning just to clean it up. We weren't looking to make any significant policy changes. We've been hearing over time about some specific concerns or issues associated with crossbows. And so, as you probably remember, the crossbows can only be used during modern firearm seasons in firearm-restricted areas by the general hunters. In addition, there are exceptions for hunters with disabilities that would allow them to use a crossbow during archery seasons. And really, we weren't looking to make any policy changes. It was just more of a cleanup was the intent to start with. And so we've removed the crossbow reference in the archery rule, and it's only, which is 0454, and now it's only referenced in 047, other than the exception for hunters with disabilities. And the bottom line is that it would allow scopes and clarify what is a legal crossbow. We do have some floor amendments associated with this, with these rules. In particular, on page 2 of 232.12.047, section 4A, we are reversing our initial recommendation for changing the draw weight recommendation, and we're taking that back to 125 pounds instead of 150. So that's our recommendation is 125. On section 4B, we're reversing our bolt weight recommendation consistent with that, back to 350 grains. In section 5 of the same rule, we're just trying to clarify. We had several comments from hunters with disabilities that they thought that they were held to a different standard based on the language that was in section 5. And so just to clarify, we're saying that hunters with disabilities may also use a crossbow during archery seasons with a special use permit as conditioned in the archery WAC. Now I'll turn it over to Don to talk about baiting of game birds.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Chair Wecker, members of the commission, I'm Don Craigie, Waterfowl Section Manager with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And as far as the baiting WAC that's in your package, recent history is that the commission requested a briefing on baiting regulations for game birds back in September 2009. In August of 2010, we brought forward a proposed rule to align our state regulations with federal regulations on baiting. And at that time, there was discussion and no action. It was deferred to the three-year season package process. And as Dave described on the, we had an abbreviated process this year with the governor's suspension of non-critical rule development. So we went right to a recommendation on this to align the state and federal rules. So what is baiting? There are several similarities between the state and federal regulations, but both of the state and federal regs prohibit the hunting of game birds, migratory game birds, using bait. And baiting is actually the direct or indirect scattering of grain or other feed to attract game birds where hunters are attempting to take them. Both of the regulations allow hunting over unharvested standing crops that have been flooded, regardless of intent to harvest, and that's been a little bit controversial and a lot of concern over some of the practices to intentionally flood corn, but that is a legal practice. And also, both regs allow hunting over harvested fields depending on the method of harvest. This slide's a little bit hard to read in some parts, but there are differences between the state and federal regs that currently exist. In general, our state WAC is much more vague, I would say, and more simply worded than the federal regs, which have become a little more detailed. So the state regs apply to all game birds. The federal regs apply to migratory game birds only. So that's one obvious difference, that the federal regs are only for migratory game birds. As far as the definition of agricultural practices, we don't have that in our state WAC. That's one of the main differences between the two regulations. There is one in the federal regs. Hunting over a baited area is in our WAC is prohibited regardless of a hunter's knowledge that there's bait there. But in the federal regs, it states that it's prohibited if a hunter knows or reasonably should know about the bait. So that's one difference between our regs, too. Hunting on areas where grains are inadvertently scattered from hunting activities, in our current state WAC, it's prohibited. But in the federal regs, that would be allowed. And then finally, hunting doves or bandtails over cut grain or other crop manipulations, in our regs, is prohibited, and in the federal regs, would be allowed. So basically, the one of the main differences I just pointed out was the federal regs provide specific definitions for agricultural practices. So they're more detailed, and they define what is a normal practice as far as planting, harvesting, and post-harvest, which are not defined in our regs right now. So ours are, as I mentioned, somewhat more vague and open to more interpretation. Why do we want to standardize the baiting regulations? Well, they're different for the same species, enforced differently by two different agencies. So landowners and hunters need more clarity to know what is prohibited, and standardized regulations will allow officers to effectively identify violations and enforce baiting rules. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has initiated an information campaign over the last several years to let hunters and landowners know what is and isn't legal. So there's information in our pamphlet now that details the federal regulations and information on their website. So our recommendation for this WAC is to modify our current baiting rule, 232.12.264, to make our state rule consistent with federal law.
The next one up is...
Before you go on, excuse us. Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And just a brief comment to follow our protocol on how we're going to go through these things. The Wildlife Committee did go through these things, and I guess for the full commission, we're trying to simplify as well as coordinate our efforts with the federal regulations and trying to stay with our overall strategy of not improving technology, i.e. as in the crossbow scoping things, but still allow opportunities where it necessitates. So it's a consistency to try to simplify and still try to control technology advancements without putting a burden on the resource. On the waterfowl thing, as most of us know and some may not, that the federal regulations set the maximum limits to what we can do. We can, as a commission, can set stuff more conservative, but we can't change what the federal regulations are. And to simplify that and coordinating that with the federal law makes sense to us, as well as it makes it more efficient for our enforcement people to adhere to regulations and for our hunters to know more clearly what's allowed and what isn't. So it's trying to simplify, coordinate, and as well as maintain an ongoing strategy we have. And I think it was pretty well discussed, and this, I think, heads us in that direction.
Commissioner Perry.
I would support the proposal by the department.
Could you push your button,
please? Excuse me. To make the regulations consistent with the state regulation, consistent with the federal. However, I think the baiting situation is, in my opinion at least, is anything but clear. even under the federal regulations. And I would like to see us discuss this at some other time to try to clarify in no uncertain terms exactly what is baiting and what isn't. This relates not only to waterfowl, but to upland birds, big game, so forth. I think it's much wider than waterfowl, and I think there needs to be a discussion on that, not now, but sometime in the fairly near future we ought to bring that up.
Okay, back to hunting at night.
Madam Chair, can I, before we leave that, could I ask a
Director
question?
Director Anderson.
Thank you. Don, you showed a picture, a couple of pictures up there, one where it looked like, well, you showed that one picture, but you, and those two, you showed those two pictures, and I assume there's a reason you showed those two pictures. There's a message there. I'm not sure what the message is.
Okay. In this example, this is a field of standing corn. There was equipment or vehicles drove through that area, and the next slide shows where, you know, grain was exposed. In the federal rule, this would not be part of a normal agricultural harvest or post-harvest manipulation. So this would be a baiting situation to hunt over a an area like this where the grain had been exposed. And the same thing around a grain elevator or other type operation that's not just a normal harvest.
But just to follow up, but if that in the previous picture, if that had been caused by a combine going down through there and harvesting that corn through that area, and there had been some grain left behind as a result of that combine going down through there, what would that in terms of the definition in the federal law, what
that would be a normal agricultural practice, a normal harvest with a combine going through, even if there is grain left behind.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Madam
Commissioner
Chair,
Pierre.
I think this is an excellent example of what's confusing. I don't think a person could maybe tell which was which there, one illegal and one illegal, look pretty much the same. And again, I think that's part of the problem here. We need more clearer definitions, and again, this discussion needs to take place.
Okay, I think we're ready to go on to the next one. Hunting at night was an issue that was brought to us from our enforcement program, and the issue was that we needed to clarify the rules so that it was easier to interpret what night hunters were pursuing, and essentially the intent was to try to reduce spotlighting of deer and elk under the guise of small game hunting. So we drafted and redrafted the rules a couple of times, but still when we went out for public comment, we did not receive much support for the language that we were able to develop, both from the public comment period, but as well as from the Game Management Advisory Council. And while we know that we need to come back to this and continue to work on it, we are withdrawing this proposal at this time. It's still a significant issue for us and for enforcement folks, and so, we'll be working with hunters and others to try to craft something that works a little better and to try to address this issue.
Commissioner Jennings?
Could you redefine for me unclassified wildlife?
The commission has the authority to classify wildlife into several different categories. But if the commission chooses not to classify wildlife in any of those categories, then they are unclassified. And as such, there's no restrictions on killing them, or very few restrictions.
And so I recognize coyotes fall under that category. What other species do we have in the state that fall under that category?
Skunks would fall under that category. Opossums would fall under that category. I'm trying to think of other commonly pursued things, porcupines, things like that.
Thank you.
Okay.
The next issue is electronic equipment. And both baiting and the use of electronic equipment were fairly significant issues that were identified in the game management plan some years ago and are continuing to date. And so we continue to bring these issues forward for debate. Commissioner Perry was right on in terms of the baiting issue. That's been discussed a lot of times, and we've struggled to get very much consensus out of the public for what they wanted to see us do. Well, the same is true with electronics. And so for this commission meeting, again, trying to keep it fairly simple, we weren't looking at making any major changes other than those that we had already heard in the past. And so the issue really comes down to where do we draw the line with electronics? And the Game Management Advisory Council had a good debate on this and decided that, from their perspective at least, devices that are designed to increase success are the ones that should be restricted. Although the public debate continues, and I'm sure you're going to hear lots of comments this morning. So we have two issues for this session. One is illuminated NOx for archery equipment, and the other is waterfowl decoys, electronic waterfowl decoys. I'm going to turn it back to, I guess this one's mine. So illuminated NOx, we just put this, Don actually put this together to demonstrate illuminated NOx. It's a lighted part of the arrow, the rear part of the arrow that is called the NOx that rests on the bowstring.
Madam Chair.
Yep. Commissioner Jennings.
And the point of this is to let us see that it's much easier to see the trajectory of the arrow with the lighted NOx.
Right. Just to give you a little demonstration on what it actually does.
Thank you.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And for the full commission, the Wildlife Committee is very hesitant to take technological steps forward without some significant benefit to the resource. And there's some studies that have presented that this is a conservation method that for retrieval of game and marginally maybe assisting in increasing or changing the take of game, the ability to find your animal that's wounded after dark could be greatly assisted by these. These are allowed in the majority of the states. The only significant change is that if you want to take a record book animal, the Pope and Young doesn't allow the lighted NOx kills to be accepted into the Pope and Young. But then you don't have to use them if you don't want to. So retrieval of the resource as well as the advantages of retrieval even of the broadheads that are left in pastures and fields and as well as recovering a pretty expensive item for the archers does provide some benefit. So we're interested in further input on this one, but it's one that maybe is classified technological advancement, but we're looking at it as much from a conservation point as we are as with little of the impact on the resource in terms of increasing take.
Okay. Go on.
Just to add to that, when we did a non-random opinion survey, and over 85% of the archers who responded supported allowing the use of illuminated NOx. And I can't remember the actual numbers, but it was well over 2,000 archers that participated. And I think it was over 3,000 in that survey. And I think Commissioner Duvier did a good job of talking or explaining what most of the proponents for illuminated NOx have suggested. Opponents suggest, however, that this is just the start and we'll get more pressure to allow further electronics devices that may be used or that may ultimately impact hunting's opportunities. As well as may impact the public's perception of hunting. And there's I'm sure you'll hear some additional information from the public as we when we take public testimony. So our proposal, the proposal as written at this point, is to exempt illuminated knocks from the restrictions on electronic equipment that are attached to a bow or arrow. I'll turn it back to Don to talk about electronic decoys.
Okay. This issue has been debated for quite a while now, since 2000, when some new technology started to arrive in the waterfowl hunting world, electronic decoys. It's mainly a fair chase issue that we're talking about here again. The biological impacts of these decoys are not really well known, and I'll go into that a little bit more later. Initially in 2000, when these were prohibited, a group of sportsmen brought the issue to the department and the commission, and it was considered along with other technology and was prohibited at that time. Go ahead, Dave. So the Waterfowl Advisory Group was formed in 2003, and they've considered the issue several times since their formation. In July 2004, they voted to continue the prohibition, 6-2. In 2007, continue the prohibition. 2008 was changed to allow electronic decoys from December 1st on. And then most recently in July, vote to eliminate the prohibition, 8-5 vote. So the Game Management Advisory Committee at their February meeting voted to continue the prohibition of electronic waterfowl decoys. So the debate is still continuing on this. A lot of disagreement, a lot of strong opinions on both sides of this one. So as far as what is a robotic or electronic decoy, and why do hunters need those? If for waterfowl hunting, motion in your decoy set is very important, especially on calm and clear days. The idea is to try to make your set of inanimate decoys more appealing to waterfowl. Before we had electronic decoys, hunters were the main tools in the toolbox were to be proficient in calling and decoy placement. Those are still important, obviously. The motion part, though, was in the decoys was provided by manual strings, or jerk strings, what they're called, that allow the hunter to make the decoys move. And, of course, creating and hunting near on good habitat is a main factor in attracting birds. Over the years, why don't you go back one, Dave, if you could. I was just going to show on the upper left, that was kind of the first generation of electronic decoy. It just basically vibrated in the water. There was just, it's called a shaker magnet, which is basically a disc that can do the same thing. The next one to the right there shows kind of the most common one currently is the spinning wing decoy, and alternates with a flash of white and then the wing coloration on the top. There are other types that have been developed over the years, and they've been evolving. The wing flapper on the upper right, on the lower left, you see the, it's called the mallard machine, which kind of goes around in a circle and creates waves and a lot of activity. And then various combinations of these things you can see in the middle, on the bottom, then on the right is the vortex machine. I'll show you a video on that in a minute. But even on the lower right, there's a LED version that's intended to get your decoy set notice more. Not sure how effective that is. But okay, this is kind of the ultimate that's currently available, multiple electronic decoys in a set. And this is, several different types controlled by one controller called the decoy bus. Okay. So in 2001, there was quite a bit of debate on what types of decoys should be legal and what should be illegal. And after we consulted with enforcement and even the AG's office, we settled on the current wording, which is battery-powered or other electronic decoys are prohibited, versus trying to specify a type. So as far as the what the other states are doing, Oregon has a complete prohibition on electronic decoys along with us in Pennsylvania. And then there's partial prohibitions in California where spinning wing decoys are prohibited after December 1st. And in Minnesota, they're prohibited on all lands before October 8th. They start their season quite a bit earlier than we do. And then on all the wildlife areas all season. So there have been a couple different papers that have evaluated decoys. And one was by Fish and Wildlife Service in 05. One of their main finding was that it's unknown whether the decoys redistribute harvest or increase population level harvest rates. So again, this is the biological effects are unclear still. And in order to determine those, it would be very difficult and expensive. Nothing's really changed since 05 as far as that evaluation. Some other studies have been done in other states, Minnesota, North Carolina. They found no effect on wounding loss. So that's one thing that we hear as well. You're going to decrease wounding loss, but that wasn't found in the studies in those areas. Also, Drake and hen ratios. The most extensive study was done by Ackerman in 2006, and he looked at studies in six different locations from Manitoba to California, Texas, and they had over 500 experimental hunts in the study from 1999 to 2003. And what he found was that spinning wing decoys are strong attractants to kill for ducks and increased kill rates by an average of 2.4 times over traditional decoying methods. And that ranged from 1.3 to 33 times, depending on the location and the time of the season. So they've been found to be more effective for certain species versus others. Mallards and widgeon are more susceptible than species like green-winged teal. And the effectiveness is more early in the season versus later. And also the location and the flyway. The northern areas, these are more effective than the southern location. So I guess the reason for that is that there is some learning that occurs in the waterfowl population as the season goes on. So in the northern latitudes, these are the first times the birds have seen it, especially the young birds. So they're more vulnerable. So harvest is affected by many factors, including the distribution and success of breeding birds, weather, migration patterns, habitat conditions, hunter effort, and hunter efficiency. This graph shows what could happen if harvest rates are increased significantly. Again, we don't really have the information to say that that's happening with electronic decoys, but basically what happens in our models for western mallards and mid-continent mallards is that harvest rates are an input into the model. It's based on banding returns. So if harvest rates go up, seasons get more conservative. This is some new information that has just been coming out on vulnerability of juvenile female mallards compared to adults. And from this, in the year 2000, which is about when electronic decoys started to become more popular, there was an increase in the juvenile adult female ratio in the harvest. So it's coincidental. It's not really cause and effect, but there was a system change about that time, which hasn't been explained. As far as the public opinion on this issue, in 2002, we did a survey through Responsive Management, professional public opinion survey group, and the question was, would you agree or disagree that increased regulation of technology and hunting equipment and weapons is important, such as motorized waterfowl decoys and infrared night scopes? So the question's a little awkward here in that you're mixing two different issues as far as waterfowl decoys and scopes. But anyway, the waterfowl hunters in this survey, you can see in the green there are the ones that either moderately agree or strongly agree, and it's 48% agreed with that statement. As far as the general public, it was stronger, that 66% agreed with that statement. Then over the last 10 years, we've been doing quite a bit of informal work on trying to gauge public opinion on these. And these surveys are internet surveys. They're not based on random sampling or more of the scientific methods, but 46 to 57% favor the use of electronic decoys if seasons are not affected. So that's the biggest percentage. We don't really know if seasons are going to be affected, but there is a potential. 29% to 40%. Let me go back one. Yeah. 29 to 40% opposed them regardless, and then 11 to 20% favored regardless. So the debate continues. We've also heard the fact that, well, maybe if we if these are allowed, then we might increase hunter recruitment rates. And I just wanted to show the trend in migratory bird validations over the last 10 years. So in 2001 is when we had the prohibition go in, and the trend has been essentially flat since that time. So you could take that for what it's worth. You might say that it might have gone down if there was an effect, but it's been fairly stable. So I just wanted to leave with the Fish and Wildlife Service had a summary of considerations in their paper. I think it's relevant here that the biological impacts are uncertain. They're still uncertain. But the main questions are, should technology be limited? Is this equipment considered within the bounds of fair chase? And what are the impacts on traditional hunting methods and skills? So in our in the WAC language, it just simply removes waterfowl from the list of species where electronic decoys are prohibited, and deer and turkeys would still be included.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. As you can see, this area is one we're not going to make them all happy. And we've debated this, I think, every year for the last 5 or 6 years, and it's still not a clear decision. So we're still trying to look for clarity from the input. But to help the discussion, the wildlife community looked at this, and we basically have all these devices in our tool bag right now. We usually use magnets, or we use mechanical devices or strings, and we create the motion that we need. So in a real simplistic way, the question is, are we going to allow a battery to come into the system to do what we're doing with our pulling on a string or mechanical windups or the wind or whatever? So it's questionable. And the limits, harvest limits, stay the same. So we may or may not have an impact. And it's, as the science has showed us, we don't have data that shows us one way clearly or another it will impact it. I find there's nothing wrong with making people more successful if we're trying to provide incentive and opportunity and rewards for our hunting community. It's nice to go out and fill your quota when you go hunting, no matter what it is. And the quotas are set so we know what the harvest totals are so we don't impact it. And that could be the long-range impact, is that maybe the quotas would change or the days would change, or we had to withdraw a tool like this if it became too efficient. But it's open for debate. It's never going to be black and white on this one. So it's going to be a little more personal opinion and personal preference to do it. We looked at if you don't have to use them, if you don't think it's fair chase. There's people who think if I don't and they do, I'm not going to get the same benefit or same opportunity. So that's not very clear either. So it's a complex one, but it doesn't seem to have a significant impact on the resource. So it's one where we're trying to look at to see, do we provide another tool, another enhancement to our outdoor experience? So continue to give us your input and thoughts so we can make our scientific guess what is best for everybody. So appreciate your inputs.
Director Anderson, you want to respond?
I have one question and one comment. The question is, I had an opportunity to talk about this issue with my counterpart in Oregon, Roy Elliker, who's the director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And one of the things that he raised that his commission talked about in this issue was the issue of discard of batteries in the field and the litter and the issues associated with the discard of batteries in the kind of environment that waterfowl hunting is done in. Was Don, I'm just wondering if any discussion about that or any information that may have come from other states where they are allowed, whether or not that is a problem.
I did. I heard that comment, and I did talk to the my counterpart in Oregon, Brad Bales, with Oregon Fish and Wildlife. He said that that was based on his observations several years ago when electronic decoys were illegal in Oregon. They banned them in 2003. I would note, though, that some of the later models now of the electronic decoys, they use a 6-volt battery. So, you know, they're not the smaller batteries. It's more like a motorcycle battery. So it'd be less likely to have those discarded. But I guess, you know, historically he did see a problem with that on some of their wildlife areas.
Yeah. And just the comment is, in order to get this issue teed up, essentially, for the commission to debate it, we put the language that you currently see in the CR 102. We are not making a recommendation one way or the other. This is a commission debate and decision.
Okay, that's an important clarification. Thanks. Commissioner Schmitten, what's next?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. You know, I understand the electronic debate is very hotly contested. I'm a newcomer to the debate. My years here of hunting in the Columbia Basin, I always use traditional decoys, so I'm learning about this. But I can be frank, I have two concerns that I really would like to hear from the public. My first concern is when your kill rate goes from 1.3 to 33 times and you have unknown biological impacts, my conservation concerns rise a bit, and I am concerned about that. I'm not sure I'd like to see shorter seasons to adjust for it. My second one is an issue I haven't heard yet brought out, and that's cost. You know, are we further separating our wildlife fowl hunters between those that have and have not, between, or I guess perhaps driving away the part-time hunter out of the sport because he can't simply afford the technology that may be coming into the sport? So I don't know the answers to those. You do, and I'd sure like to hear about that. Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
I agree on the conservation side. Thank you, Madam Chair, by the way. I've been waterfowl hunting in this state for 65 years, so I've harvested my share of waterfowl. I don't recall, Don, what year lead shot was outlawed. Do you know that?
91.
Okay. You know, prior to that, it was a little bit different scenario that you had a lot more killing power. When they came out with steel and then some other composites that they use. Two issues. My read on, and I was really intelligent, I bought a robo-duck or two about a year or two before the then commission outlawed them, so I had a little experience with them, but they're sitting in my garage. What I found with them was that you could generally get the birds some percentage, 10, 15, 20% closer to you before you took the shot. And using steel shot, you had a much better chance of downing that bird and harvesting that bird. I think you very, very much have the opportunity to reduce the flyaway mortality. When you're hunting over standard decoys, there are birds that are injured. There are people that are much poorer shots than others. And I think the flyaway mortality is at least as big an issue as what the kill rate might be. The other issue is the batteries that I also was aware that the director from Oregon commented on. The units that I was familiar with were the 6-volt batteries that were rechargeable, quite expensive, not something you're going to leave in the field. So if this dynamics goes forward, I think there should be some requirement regarding the better quality take-home batteries so they're not leaving flashlight batteries anywhere. Thank you.
Commissioner Caney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just first like to ask Commissioner Carpenter if I could get his robo-duck from my fish pond. It worked out real good. My wife would like it. But I guess I have to agree with Commissioner Schmitten, and it's a public debate. And when you hear that the waterfowl advisory group's kind of split on it, and the management advisory group is for but kind of split in the vote, I think it comes down to one of those questions of real hunting ethics and also public perception. You know, the public views hunters in a positive or a negative way, and the ability for hunters to keep hunting, you know, has a lot to do with public. And so as they see some of the technological stuff that kind of comes out, I think sometimes they get a little worried about our sport. And I would hate to see a backlash from a lot of electronic devices where people think, oh, the game doesn't stand a chance, even though, you know, what you're saying is true, that you might actually wound less and get your limit quicker and cause less problems. But there's always this perception. And I worry, too, that as a kid going to hunt ducks and, you know, I'd get under the house and scrape up a couple of duck decoys and throw them in a burlap bag and off I went. And whether I got ducks or not didn't matter that much. It was just the fun of it being out there. And would we really be kind of isolating hunters from the sport, because the people that could buy the best gimmicks would be the ones out there. And if I'm set up next to someone that has the flapper dapper and the duck, whatever it was, the fanciest ones, you know, they're not going to come into my set of decoys, you know. And that's just, I don't know, it kind of grates me a little bit, not against, you know, some of the technology out in the hunting world, but this one just seems to bother me for some reason, just as I grew up hunting. And you know, is it really only the people with the dollars that can afford the best technology that are given these opportunities? You know, that, I think that'd be something for all of us to think about.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to respond to a comment from Commissioner Carpenter about the they come in closer, so you might have a better kill ratio. I think, Dave, thank you very much for numbering the slides. On slide 27 in the handout, in fact, the data doesn't support that assumption. It seems like a logical conclusion, but when they've done the tests in the field, that was not the finding. At least according to this, no effect on wounding, loss, drake, hen, harvest ratios.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter?
Well, Commissioner Jennings, that might be someone's study. I don't know if they've done much hunting, but I think any of the participants in this room that have done waterfowl hunting will tell you that if the birds are closer, you'll have a higher kill rate and a less flyaway mortality rate. I mean, that's a matter of fact. The other issue that I did bring up earlier, and I'll bring up now, and I'm not hard over one way or the other on this, but I think there has to be some real clarity here. Later in the season, the birds over in eastern Washington, particularly based on, or western Washington for that matter, based on weather conditions, more weather conditions than anything, they get stressed. And if you're hunting in a popular hunting area and accessing some ducks, if you have, if your rate of harvest is better than without these robo-ducks, you'll get your birds, whatever number of birds you want to take home, and get out of the field, thereby allowing the birds to come back into the area that they might want to rest and feed in, and reduce the amount of stress level. I think that's a real consideration, too.
Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I totally understand that the birds are closer, the kill rate is higher. I think that doesn't account for human behavior, which says they're close enough and I'm going to take my shot now. And I think that's what my sense of what the reality of the situation is not that people are a little impatient, and they, as soon as they get close enough, they take the shot, and that's what's my interpretation of what the studies are showing us. But I totally agree, you get closer, you're, you know.
Okay, we've got quite a few people who want to in line here to speak. I think Commissioner Perry was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wanted to maybe reinforce some of the things that have already been said. I think that when I go hunting, whether it be for waterfowl, I've been that for a long time, or big game, really it's experience being out in the field and getting together with friends and doing this. If we kill something, that's great. If we don't, we still have a good time. And I think that still should be part of the focus of this. having all kinds of mechanical equipment out there to ensure your success doesn't seem to be very desirable. And from my standpoint, that's a personal opinion, but it's one I hold pretty strongly. Also, as far as impacting the resource out there, the limits stay the same. However, using these mechanical things from what I've been able to determine increases your ability to take a limit. So even though the limits are the same, people are probably going to take more limits than they would without these devices, and I think that has a good possibility of impacting the resource, the waterfowl resource. That apparently there isn't any studies that show that, and it would be difficult to get that information, but it just seems to me that if we're killing more ducks, we may impact that resource. I will admit that waterfowl are doing really well right now, at least it seems like it from my reading, and we probably wouldn't have much of an effect, but if we get other impacts like on nesting areas and so forth, it certainly might have. Thank you.
Okay. Before we proceed in debating this topic anymore, the director rightly reminded me that this is the opportunity for public input. We will have an opportunity in April to debate the pros and cons, and what we're here to do here today primarily is receive public input. This is our one and only chance for a public hearing on this topic. So, Commissioner Smith, do you want to question or comment on the briefing?
No. Given your last comments, I was just going to reinforce some of the articles or comments that have been said.
So you'll defer that till April.
I will defer that.
Okay. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to have a clarification because we've been talking about the significant increase in success. And when I read the reports, the mechanical devices of moving wings significantly increased success. It wasn't electronic added. It was the fact that, and most people now do use some kind of motion in the field. So it isn't adding electronics is going to be that significant change that's already taken place because that study says when they want to wing spinning mobile decoys, they increase the success rate.
The mechanical or the wind-powered haven't been studied that much. It's mainly been the electronic wing spinning ones. And from the work that's been done, there's apparently an optimal RPM of the wings that attract birds versus other, you know, if they're too slow, too fast, it might be a disincentive, I guess. So, but there hadn't been a lot of work done on that. But, the mechanical and the wind power are legal. They're wouldn't provide the same consistent kind of a pattern, though, that an electronic would.
Okay. Then let's move into the public input portion. Do we have people have signed up for this item? Okay. I'm going to call up more than one person at a time, and if you would just stand by on deck, front table, I appreciate it. First to Ren Sarns and BJ Thornley. Okay, Mr. Sarns, you're first.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioners, Director. Here to discuss the lighted knock issue. I also sit on the Game Management Advisory Council. I'm the hunting VP from the Washington State Archery Association. I'm also the board chairman of the Archery Coalition. Lighted knocks, this has been going on very heatedly within our community and in front of the commission over the last 2 years. One of the big proponents is that this will allow the lighted knock to help you recover your animal. I dispute that. 75% of the animals shot from people that I've surveyed and over 300 people surveyed their arrows have completely passed through. It will help you recover your arrow. You should be able to recover your arrow without a lighted knock. If you're shooting within the daylight hours of the hunting times and you've taken an ethical shot within your abilities and within a distance that you can shoot, you should still be able to recover your arrow. Lighted knock gives us nothing. If the arrow strikes the bone of the animal, which sticks into the animal and the arrow will be stuck to it, the knock, if you have shot any archery at all, when you hit a hard object like a piece of rebar in a 3D target or a rock or a bone of an animal, the knocks are not glued on. They're pushed on. The knock from the force of the impact pops off. How does that help you recover your animal? The knock's laying there where the animal was when you shot it. It is no longer with the animal. If the knock in that 10% chance stayed attached to the arrow, as the animal runs through the brush, what happens to the arrow? It gets broken off and it's laying there. How does that help you recover the animal? It does not. Our heritage and our tradition as bow hunters is the ability to take ethical, sane shots at the animal within our abilities and be able to track the animal properly, spend the time in the woods and be able to do process of tracking to recover your animal. The statements that was made by the individual proposing this in front of the commission was that we have a dark secret, which was posted in the newspaper in the Spokane thing, of extreme wounding loss of animals. Yet there are several studies that's been done, the Ridley study, the University of Minnesota study, and what's even taught in the Washington State hunter education, of we have a 13% loss, which is at or below muzzleloader and modern firearm losses. So why do we need electronics attached to our bow? We do not. Will it help you find your arrow? And I think I talked a little bit about that. It may not. If you hit a rock, if you hit a stump, if you hit something, the knock's going to come off. It's probably going to be damaged anyway. Do we have something already there that will do this for us? Yes, we have.
Darn it.
We have brightly colored arrows, fletchings, etc., that do the job already. And last thing is, there's a lighted knock available out there already that has no electronics that is legal. Why do we need this knock?
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Would Stuart Mitchell come forward, please?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, I'm B.J. Thornley, sometimes called Bobby, and I'm representing the Washington State Trappers Association and Washingtonians for Wildlife Conservation. Washingtonians for Wildlife Conservation Board of Directors have formally voted to support the use of the lighted knock. We don't necessarily agree, and some of our members don't agree with some of the comments that have been made previously. We do all try for the perfect shot, but sometimes that doesn't happen. And the lighted knock will help you recover your arrow so that you can see, if necessary, what kind of a shot you had, what kind of a hit, or they do stay in the animal, and it does help. That's the main purpose. The secondary purpose, and Commissioner Duvier mentioned it, is landowners. I've done quite a bit of work with landowners in past years and a few years, and on the subject of archers and what their complaints are. And one of the ranchers and the agriculture people's biggest complaints are arrows that are not found in the field. And they're left out there, they harvest, or their animals are in the field, and it creates all kinds of problems. So that's really not a small thing to have happen. It is a secondary purpose, but it's a good purpose. Okay, they do not affect the shot. That's up to the hunter. If he doesn't make a good shot, that's his fault or hers. The argument, and one of the arguments against it, of course, is that it's not approved by Pope and Young, and that's the record-keeping person group, and therefore they shouldn't be allowed. Pope and Young is a record-keeping group, and if a hunter is out there trophy hunting, he better know the rules. And if he shoots a trophy animal and it's not approved by Pope and Young, that's his or her fault. The average archer does not give a hoot, I don't think, at least the ones I know, and I know quite a few, about Pope and Young. They're out there to harvest an animal and have some good eating food. If there are additional proposals, if this is approved, and you have additional proposals for more electronic stuff in the future, it can be debated, and you can say no. You don't have to approve it just because you've approved, hopefully, the lighted Knox. So we do urge you to consider this carefully. It is more a recovery of the animal thing. And, of course, that secondary idea of making our landowners a little more positive about allowing archers on the property, because I've known several who have said absolutely not. You know, we get the arrows in the hay bales, the animals get in them. So please seriously consider it. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff Hershey, would you come forward, please? Okay, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Commission, for allowing me to come up and say a few words. I've never done anything like this before, so I'm a little bit nervous on it. But I was out hunting last fall, archery hunting, and hunted a very small area in 101 and hunted 9 days. And there were three of us hunting. And of the three of us, we come on to 7 bait stands, and the majority of them had cameras on them. I personally ran into 5, and I don't get around like I used to. I hunt very, very slow anymore. I don't think that this is in the realm of sportsmanship or ethics to be able to lure animals in of any kind. In my book, you can't do it with fish in most cases, and it's certainly against the rules with bear. Why do they have preference over some of our other valuable animals? And it's not ethical, and it's not sportsmanship. And I'd just like to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mike Miesper, could you come forward? Okay, Mr. Hershey.
In the interest of time, I'll just decline to comment. My concerns have already been addressed. Thanks.
Thanks. Tony Burnson, please come forward. Mr. Miesper.
Madam Chairman and Commission, thanks for coming to Moses Lake. Make this a nice short ride when you live south of here, about 15 miles. But thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of duck hunters who want the prohibition of battery-operated decoys lifted. Once again, I'm Mike Miesberg. I am the vice chair of the Waterfowl Advisory Group. On July 23, the WAG had a majority vote to lift the prohibition. WDFW initiated a survey through a non-biased group that measured over 70% in favor of lifting the prohibition on battery-operated duck hunting decoys in Washington. And as a member of the Inland, I'm also on the Inland Fish Advisory Group, and as a member of that, I'm keenly aware that the WDFW's current campaign to increase license sales will determine the future health of this department. With improved hunting success through the use of battery-operated decoys, WDFW will enjoy increased hunting license sales. And why do I say this? Experienced waterfowl hunters that have used battery-operated decoys have witnessed more kill shots with much less marginal distance shooting, which results in less cripples and more birds in the bag, which in the end results in a better hunter satisfaction, which in the end will sell more licenses because of increased hunter enthusiasm. The hunter will go home and share his experience with his friends, his neighbors, and his relatives. And that's a fun thing to do. I'd also like to ask that the Commission, upon a successful lift of this prohibition, that you consider charging hunters an endorsement to use battery-operated decoys. And in conclusion, considering a positive vote along with the WAG, positive results from the inline survey, I respectfully ask that you honor the wishes of these waterfowlers, your customers, the licensed purchasers. And did you all receive the information that I submitted? Would you please look at the second page from a previous event? I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Bruce Fegan, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Burnson.
Hi, I'm Tony Burnson. Thank you for being in Moses Lake. On the battery-operated or assisted decoys for waterfowl, I'd like to point out that battery-operated attracted devices, not so much even before the decoys, we had the magnets that the gentleman from Fish and Wildlife had explained, and when the spinning wings were banned, it also eliminated all the other devices. Commissioner Smitten had said that the it may eliminate a certain number of individuals, the haves versus the have-nots. The magnet type were quite inexpensive, and most anyone would be able to afford those. And it's all basically what your means are at the time, but it still doesn't eliminate a person from being able to use them in the field. As Commissioner Carpenter stated, that we are only entitled to X amount of ducks or geese per day. I think it's everyone's right to be able to go out with a reasonable expectation of taking your limit. You're paying for that privilege. It is a privilege. It's not a right. And you still have to have calling experience, knowledge of the wind, the quarry that you're after, and just good hunting ethics and intelligence. I think the spinning wing leveled the playing field for the person I hunt every day. And but for the person that doesn't, that's coming over from the west side or youth that have limited time or limited calling experience or without the great numbers of decoys, that it levels the playing field, that they have a reasonable expectation to be able to go out and harvest waterfowl. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Raymond Bourbon, please come forward. Mr. Fagan.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Fagan. I live here in Grant County, and I'm a lifelong waterfowl hunter. I'd like to say that I have some new and brilliant, insightful thing to share with the commission, but it looks like the commission has been completely briefed on the issue. I'd like to say that Commissioner Carpenter reflected some of my opinions as an experienced hunter about the use of the waterfowl decoys and the success and the limitation of the wounded and lost game. I am a member of several waterfowl hunting organizations. Those people that I speak with, they virtually universally share the opinion that the electronic decoy is a positive factor out in the field, that it enhances the experience for the potentially new or novice hunter and allows them to get into the field of waterfowl hunting, something that's a big interest to me. I urge you to listen to the voice that was spoken by the members that took the survey, and again, I think the language as published in the handout today that removes waterfowl from the prohibition is appropriate and is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Jay St. Charles, please come forward. Mr. Bourbon.
Good morning. My name is Raymond Bourbon. I'm here to talk about the illuminated NOx and the change to the archery regulations. Upon hearing about the proposal, I reviewed some of the testimony that was given some time ago, and it seemed that the premise behind the idea was that bow hunting was basically broken because we needed to have these illuminated NOx to find our animals. And I have a problem with that. It's not based on science. Some of the reports that were given in the testimony seemed quite anecdotal, and as was previously discussed earlier by Mr. Sarnes, there's been a study that's been published, and it's in the it's a scientific study, and it basically states definitions of wounding, and when you review the Riley study, you can determine from their report that archers are really only wounding as many animals as rifle hunters, and we have no requirement for this illuminated knock. We've lived without it for decades, and I think it sends a bad message to the public. The truth is, it's the user who creates success in the field and the decisions they make prior to making their shot, and how do they recover their animal? Experience, knowledge, patience. And I think drawing a line in the sand on electronic equipment on archery is probably a very wise thing to do and to consider when you guys take this issue up. You'll probably see more advancements in the archery community from manufacturers or users in the future, maybe on different subjects, and I hope you take each one into careful consideration. And that's it.
Thank you. Dale Sharp, would you come forward? Dale Sharp? Okay. Mr. St. Charles?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you to the Wildlife Commission and Director Anderson providing us with this opportunity to speak. I'm speaking with regard to the lighted knock issue, and my primary concern, the reason I'm here today, has to do with testimony leading up to this recommendation to accept the knock. And I'm pleased to see that in the comments that were printed here that most of the, what I would refer to as misinformation or inflammatory statements are gone. The comments just talk about the knock. Although I would say they don't also talk about a critical issue as far as a conservation measure or a critical or about from an economic standpoint. I don't know that they make that case in this issue. As Mr. Bourbon stated earlier, there's actually a vast array of data that speaks to wounding losses in bow hunting and that do place it at the same level as rifle or muzzleloader. And in other words, nowhere in the country is it a controversy other than apparently here in Washington State at this moment. I want to say, too, that I need to say I'm also a past board member of the International Bowhunter Education Foundation. I'm a current board member of the Pope and Young Club. And from the commercial side, my family, the St. Charles family, operated the largest retail archery store in the Pacific Northwest for over 55 years. I've learned a lot about bow hunting through my lifetime. And this week before I came here, I talked personally to the members of the Archery Trade Association, the national body that governs commercial archery in the United States, and it's an association of manufacturers primarily. And I spoke with the International Bowhunter Education Foundation office, and we actually received a letter from Marilyn Bentz with some information, some study information that's on your desk right now that speaks to that issue. And I also spoke to Pope and Young Club, and what I was speaking is some notice that there is data that I haven't been aware of, and they know of no data that spoke differently than 13%. Thank you.
Thank you. Ed Forskoff, please come forward. Mr. Sharp.
Madam Chair, didn't recognize me with my hair off, did you? Members of the commission, deputy, Mr. Director and Deputy Director, hi. I'm Dale Sharp from Renton. I'm the president of Traditional Bowhunters of Washington, and I'm here to speak on the topic of technology getting its nose under the proverbial wall of the tent. There have been, in my estimation, some false charges of wounding loss used to promote a product. And an attack on the integrity of bow hunting for the sake of promoting a product that comes from someone who is himself a bow hunter is a little disturbing and damaging. But I don't believe he meant to cause any harm to bow hunting or to directly misinform, but I think he merely proceeded with what he thought was correct without learning the true facts regarding the wounding statistics. He testified to you on December 4, 2011, that this knock will stop the taking of more than one animal, and that's in your video or your audio transcripts dated December 4, item 6. During testimony in front of you, he claimed the conservation and economic gains we've made, but no evidence of this has been able to be brought forth because it simply doesn't exist. He claimed in front of the GMAC that this knock will stop bow hunters from killing two or three deer before they tag one. He told them that on February 11 of this year. He was invited to speak there, but no evidence speaks to that. You have the reports. 13% is the national average. After that meeting, he came up to me and told me he had a friend who sells lighted knocks or is in the business that would benefit from lighted knocks. And that friend had asked him, will other items be allowed into Washington if you're successful here? And he told me, no, it won't. But that's just an indication that lighted sights, mechanical broadheads, all these things are going to be brought to the table if this line in the sand is crossed. There was a very low return on the survey that came back that the department sent out asking a simple question, should lighted knocks be allowed? 23,000 surveys were sent out. 10% of those came back. I don't think that's very representative. And I think that we're people who were bow hunters who have a stake in it would be asked, different results would be shown. In fact, the largest internet hunting site, huntingwashington.com, with 10,500 users asked a similar question, and it was split down the middle. Only 100 people replied, or 65, 80 people. 35, yes, I would use it. 37, no, I wouldn't. 6 had no opinion. That's more representative of what I hear out there. What that tells me is that if you ask people who don't have something, would you like to be allowed to do it, they're going to naturally say yes. Would you like fries with that? That's the natural reply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Michael Crowder, would you come forward?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members, Director Anderson. I'm Ed Forsloff, past president of the Evergreen Archery Club, Washington State Archery Association, Washington Wildlife Federation, and the Washington State Sportsman's Council. I've been a hunter ed instructor for 30-plus years and a bow hunter ed instructor. Today I'm representing Evergreen Archery Club of Spokane, Washington. We are opposed to legalizing lighted knocks. Lighted knocks are being presented as a cure for poor judgments. Lighted knocks will not reduce wounding. Wounding is a result of several factors: bad lighting, bad range estimation, poor shooting ability, and inexperience. This all occurs before the arrows are released and the light activated. Bowhunter education is a far greater benefit to wounding and game recovery. 20-plus years ago, archers asked for a ban on lighted sights. As a result, fiber optic sights have become one of the greatest tools available to bow hunters today. I believe the same thing will occur with lighted knocks. Do not allow them. Let the technology go towards the direction of fiber optics, and you will achieve the same benefit that's being claimed. Keep technology off of the equipment. Bow hunters are prideful of the fact that this is a primitive firearm, and we really desire to keep it that way. Do not be swayed by the hype and salesmanship. A poorly written and presented survey, the information that survey generated, is not an accurate representation of bow hunters' desires. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Chris Doro, please come forward. Mr. Crowder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Crowder. I'm from West Richland, and I've spoken to this group several times on the waterfowl issue and a lot of familiar faces. I'm a current member of the Waterfowl Advisory Group and a past chair. I have spoken four times on this issue, twice as the president, and once for and once against representing the commission or the advisory group. So the take-home mission or idea is not a lot has changed since 2001. The people are for it or for it. The people are against it are going to be against it. You're not going to sway the opinion. It truly is a fair chase issue. It's really perceptions. If a hunter thinks that the ducks might swing around one more time to get closer, then they're not going to shoot a little bit further. That's my personal opinion on what happens. I'm not sure. They're absolutely more effective. It's proven science. But the perception of a general hunter in the field will probably get you more birds just because you'll hold off that one pass. And I want to caveat everything I say by I have no recommendation, so I probably shouldn't even be sitting here. But I just feel like it's an issue that really hasn't changed. And so thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for no recommendation. Okay, Mr. Darrow.
Madam Chair and Commission, my name is Chris Darrow. I'm from Othello, Washington. I am also a member of the Waterfowl Advisory Board. I actually came up with Michael Crowder, so we have been having this debate all the way up. We will probably be having it all the way home as well. I also serve as the regional vice president of Ducks Unlimited for the Pacific Flyway. And I signed up to testify today to make sure the groups and organizations which I represent and lead were accurate in the information they gave to you. This issue does generate a lot of emotion, as you can see from the testimony, from your comments, and everything you've received on this issue. I do think I didn't intend to say anything more about this issue, similar to Michael Crowder. However, Commissioner Schmitten, when you asked about opinions, I do think it's important to have lots of opinions. Observations that I'd like to share is when batteries were outlawed, the human came up with technology quickly, and there were just as many mechanical options for spinning wing decoys within a couple of years out there. So there's just as much mechanized decoys as there were before, only now powered from a different thing. I think at this point, the only thing that we've been able to accomplish in Washington is regulating convenience. I'm not sure that's a great direction for the state at this time, and I would hope that when we look at all of the data that we consider that issue has really been what we've resolved and not necessarily fair chase. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the public input for this item. So the hearing is now closed. We are about a half an hour behind schedule, and we've got two more items before lunch. I guess we should just plow ahead and try to do this as efficiently as possible, fellow commissioners.